Exhibit Number 89, that the victim had been sitting in a patio chair when he received the first blow, People's Exhibit Number 74, and that he had been heard crying out for help, Witness Number 17, Clemencia Salar. How many autopsies have you performed? The prosecutor asked the coroner, his first witness.
More than 5,000, sir.
How many with head trauma?
Hundreds, I'd estimate.
The coroner located and pointed out in photographs two fatal wounds. The declared cause of death was severe cranial cerebral trauma. The coroner noted that Mr. Kennedy seemed to have vomited up a large amount of blood on the defendant's porch. How many impacts did Mr. Kennedy's head receive? The prosecutor asked.
At least four, possibly five.
Would there have been a fair amount of pain for Mr. Kennedy receiving these injuries?
Oh, yes.
Are these other injuries on his arms and hands typical when someone is trying to defend himself?
Yes, that's correct.
Isn't it true that a person in his mid-50s will require less force to fracture the skull than someone much younger? This was asked by Johnson's lawyer on cross-examination.
I suppose so, but...
Objection. Hypothetical.
Sustained.
The prosecutor called one of my other neighbors as a witness. Clemence Salar would say anything to get attention, such as tell them she heard Kurt cry out for help. She was a liar. A witness for the defense, a guy named Coronado, lived one house over from Clemence. He and I had never had a conversation. He only spoke Spanish, and I only speak English. I remembered seeing him out there working on cars. Once, a car that belonged to him leaked an entire tank of gasoline onto the street, and another neighbor yelled at him. He had told the police he'd seen Kurt Kennedy pull up on his motorcycle, park, and wait. He heard arguing and was sure that what happened was self-defense. That was the plan. Johnson's lawyer had interviewed him, and the man was agreeable. He would provide testimony. Mr. Coronado has bench warrants in San Bernardino County, the prosecutor told the judge. He's had a series of DUIs over the years and has done mandatory treatment. An interpreter translated for the witness, my neighbor, Mr. Coronado, who turned to the judge and spoke. The interpreter translated,
Your Honor, I want to clear this up right now. I'm ready to clear it up. I will do whatever is necessary.
The judge and court clerk consulted loudly about the man's warrant and which court took walk-ins or didn't.
Sir, your legal troubles are in San Bernardino County. You'll have to take it up with them. It's Friday and they don't take walk-ins today. Go there on Monday morning.
The man spoke again, seeming not to have absorbed what the interpreter told him.
Your Honor, I'm ready. I will pay the fees and serve the time. I want to clear this up right now. I'm ready, Your Honor. I want to clear this up.
That was our witness, a man who wanted to help me, but couldn't. On the day of closing arguments, Johnson's lawyer seemed drunk. He shouted at the jury and stomped his foot. He addressed them in a scolding voice as if they, the jury, had done something wrong. The jury didn't want anything to do with him or me. They completed a form and handed it to the judge. There are two boxes on the form. The foreman checked one. Chapter 6. Children must be supervised, quiet, and behaved at all times, or guardians will be asked to remove them from the visiting area. Inmates cannot handle vending machine cards. Vending machines do not accept cash. You must buy a prepaid card in visitor processing. Cards cost $5. $2.50 will be returned if your card is in reusable condition. Inmates can stand no closer than 3 feet from vending machines. One short hug is acceptable at the beginning of your visit, and one very brief hug at the end of the visit. No sustained bodily contact, or the visit will be terminated. Holding hands is sustained contact and not tolerated. No high fives. No hands under the table during your visit.
Visitors and inmates must keep hands where officers can see them at all times. No hands in pockets, no yelling, no raised voices, no arguments, no horseplay, no loud laughing or boisterousness. Keep crying to a minimum.
Chapter 7. The road to Stanville Prison is straight. It goes toward the mountains, which can be seen from the main yard on low smog days. In winter, their caps are dusted white. The snow is far away. It never falls on the valley floor where Stanville is. We see those caps of white through the baked layers of valley air. The snow is as remote to us as home. Only people who should be on the road to Stanville are on that road. The morning of our arrival, no one was on it but us. The road was lined on both sides by almond orchards. I would not have known what was growing, or cared, except that Laura Lipp was awake and talking again, and she said what they package as almonds are not real almonds, but instead poisonous fruit seeds. Did I know? And that one of her children had almost died from eating them. "You ever split open a peach pit?" Laura Lipp said. "That's where they come from. They aren't actual almonds. They're the poisonous part of a peach. A neighbor once gave my kid some without asking me first, and if it weren't for the paramedics, she would have killed him." "You killed him," a woman behind us said. I felt a wave around me, people tisking in disgust. White women in prison have two crimes, baby killer or drunk driving. Of course, they have many more crimes, but those are the stereotypes which help to impose an order among the women, the races. "They don't know what happened," Laura Lipp said. "About him and what he did to me, what he did to us, to me and the baby. None of you has a right to judge me. You don't know anything, just like I don't know anything about you." She turned to me as if I were the one person she could reason with. "Do you know who Medea is?" "No," I said. "You need to be quiet. I don't know you, and I don't want to talk to you." "You want me to be quiet, but I'll shut up when I'm finished and not before. I went to college, unlike the rest of you. Medea's husband abandoned her, and that's what happened to me. He took everything from her, including her children. She had to put him in pain so he could know her pain. It's written into history. It's real. You can't do that to a person without damage. He tore her life apart, and so she found a way to do the same to him. That's my only comfort. It's very, very, very small. It's so small, I can't see it most of the time." My eyes were closed. I was turned away. I was trapped with her, but willing myself elsewhere. I pictured a woman on the landing of a hotel, picking up lint from ugly red carpeting to see if it was crack cocaine. Picking up a crumb, a match head, rug fluff, inspecting the object between her fingers, smelling it, giving it a little taste, putting it down, picking up another crumb, inspecting it the same way. She starts to cry, this woman, in her search, her endless search. It's as sad as anything I've seen. I kept seeing it, though I did not want to, while Laura Lipp talked on and on. The woman searching the carpet was Eva, I realized. I block certain things out. Everyone does. It's healthy. But in trying to block the words coming from Laura Lipp, I accidentally thought of something bad. Eva went in for coke, early on, freebasing it, then shooting it, and finally crack was enough and it was the thing. Turned skinny, lost a tooth in a fight, had a limp from a car accident, but she was still Eva, and I loved her. When you see lights even higher than stadium lights, you are at prison. They hustled us off the bus, two at a time, yelling, "Move it, let's go!" I was trying not to trip. Conan, in front of me, was unhindered. He had a walk that was unaffected by the chains. I don't know how he did it. He practically floated. He was dragging and smoothly syncopated. It was a walk that belonged on the streets of Compton or in the parking lot of the Inglewood Forum, out at the Pomona Car Show, not in a line of shackled women headed into prison receiving. The officers who greeted us were angry, especially the women. It was a rude and aggressive welcome, but it shut Laura Lipp up.
The only person who got gentle treatment was the extra-large-sized lady who had slid off her bus seat. They let her lie quietly as we more able-bodied and conscious women were prodded down the aisle of the bus. The woman looked to be peacefully sleeping when I shuffled past her. The last passenger, she was moved off the vehicle in a stretcher by medics who pronounced her dead and placed her on the floor of receiving with a tarp over her face. The rest of us lined up for debugging and moo-moos. The lieutenant was called Jones, a big Mack truck-shaped lady who was, I later came to understand, partly shaped like that on account of her stab-proof vest. The vests make the men look gym-pumped and the women look like packing crates. We slathered ourselves with lindane lotion to kill lice and whatever else. It's a poison. Twice before I'd used it for scabies I'd contracted at the Mars room, and both times I started menstruating within hours. They wanted the girl, the 15-year-old, who looked 8 months pregnant, to use it as well. I told her not to. We were next to each other in the showers. They forced her, and she cried while applying her lindane. If she were officially declared pregnant, she could be excused from certain procedures, but that designation had to be on her bed card, and none of us had bed cards yet. She would have to wait, like the rest of us, until her scheduled medical exam, and then for the requisite paperwork from her pregnancy test, which she had to have, even if you could practically see the baby kicking. Eventually, she would be issued a CDC pregnant designation, with state clothing that announced it in enormous block letters on the back of her shirt and her state property rain jacket. She'd be allowed no extra food, no prenatal exams, no vitamins, no counseling. All she would get was a bottom bunk and extra time to go prone when the alarm sounded on the yard. That's why the jacket said, pregnant. It was like SWAT. It meant, don't shoot. I'm slow. Next was the strip search, which I was accustomed to from jail. The guards were yelling at us to spread wider, especially at women with thicker pubic hair. They shone their lights on us as we bent over for them. Some of the girls were crying. Fernandez, who had yelled at the young pregnant girl to shut up when we first got on the bus, was yelling again at the girls who were crying about the strip search. The cops all knew her. "Fernandez, back again," they kept saying. And she would either be friendly and joke or tell them to fuck off. The other girls seemed afraid of her. They gave us one-size-fits-all polka-dot muumuus and three-sizes-fit-most canvas slippers. Even big and burly Conan, with his jawline beard, was forced to wear a muumuu. He threw his shoulders back to show the cops the muumuu was too small. "I need pants and a shirt. I can't wear this. It ain't right, Sarge." He kept raising his arms. "It's too tight in the shoulders." Jones said, "What are you planning to do in it, ma'am? Conduct an orchestra? Shut up and put your arms down." The muumuus made me think of that expression, lipstick on a pig. No woman should be compared to a pig nor made to wear the garment they gave us. And no Conan either. The slippers were okay. They reminded me of winos, the shoes we wore growing up, which you could purchase at the Army-Navy place on Market Street. It was where I got my school gym uniforms as well. Later, I passed it as an adult on my way to the Mars room. Both were near the corner where the businessmen getting in the Mercedes had promised money for a cab on a rainy night. San Francisco was like that, a city where the layers of my history all compressed together onto a single plane. Between the Army-Navy place and the Mars room was fascination, where Eva and I spent many hours as teenagers while Eva flirted with the cashier before she was lost to the Tenderloin, north of Fascination, up in the boisterous and dirty hotels that form the pearls on the chain of her bare life, barer even than mine. The last time I saw Eva was at the wedding of another friend, a former prostitute who got clean, met another guy in recovery, and joined with him the Church of Christ. We all went to an alcohol-free wedding where people smiled like we were on Christian TV. They had done something to our friend. I could see it in her face. She sobbed at the altar. It was clear to me that there had been a reckoning. They'd broken her down, and now they were her moral overlords. She looked beautiful, like an arrangement of plastic flowers in a funeral home. Another Sunset District girl at the wedding kept making references to her boyfriend and how he couldn't come with her because a guy in his club had died and there was a funeral for him that morning. His club. There was a big public funeral that day for a Hell's Angel. She wanted to brag, but she wanted to seem like she was being discreet. She kept talking about what good money she made as a waitress on Pier 39. She said, as if she somehow knew what I did for a living, "I make my money respectably. Pier 39 is garbage." Eva showed up halfway through the ceremony, walked in with this greaseball. They looked like they'd been up for 3 days. Eva's face was coated in foundation that was a full shade too light for her skin. She kept her sunglasses on inside, turned to me in her half-erasing makeup. "Romy, what the fuck is going on here?" It was the right question, was the thing. The greaseball was probably her dealer. She said boyfriend, but that distinction doesn't matter. The year before, Eva had been with a guy who was originally a John. He became a regular, and then he didn't want her seeing any other Johns. He started funding her drug habit so she didn't have to work the streets. This guy was waiting outside the Mars room one night to talk to me. He was looking for Eva. He was distressed. He said he'd spent $80,000 on her cocaine habit that year, and now she was gone. What did he expect? I didn't question that he loved her, or at least that he knew he'd never get a woman like Eva, that gorgeous and free, without doling out the money, and without her being first and foremost an addict who needed something from him. "Get away from me," I said, and left him standing at the entrance to the theater. Henry was his name, the John obsessed with Eva. He started appearing almost everywhere I went, hoping I was on my way to meet Eva and he could trap her. But I hadn't talked to Eva, didn't know where she was, and she wasn't the kind of person you can call on the phone. I had about 10 numbers for her, and none of them worked. Later, I forgot all about Henry in that episode because soon I had my own stalker, Kurt Kennedy. Henry wasn't really my stalker, but Eva's. He only stalked or shadowed me in order to locate her. Eva disappeared to escape him. When I think of Henry or of Kurt, the tissue of my throat goes hard. We were chained to a bench in a hall, waiting to be interviewed in a little concrete room about drug use, sexual history, mental health, and whether or not we had gang affiliations or enemies currently serving time at Stanville. After several hours of this, they gave us each a bedroll and a CDC Offender's Handbook, as well as a 40-page guide to the CDC Offender's Handbook. Conan wondered out loud if we would also be getting a guide to the handbook. "The failure to report a rule violation," Conan said in a nasal voice, "is also a rule violation. The failure to report a rule violation of a failure to report a rule violation is another rule violation." Jones said, "Not even 6 hours in prison, London, and you just earned your first 115. I figured she was being sarcastic, but she went over to the cop shop and started writing him up. "London," someone said. "London." Some of the girls laughed and snickered that Conan was getting written up. You'd think we would band together. Even our ragtag crew from the bus, with all 60 of us, we could have subdued the 2 transport cops easily enough, hijacked that vehicle, and gone to Mexico. But there was no cooperation, just people eager to see others fall under the hammer they suffered under themselves. It had been like that in jail, too. When I first got to county, I had lost my styrofoam cup right away. It looked disposable, but was the only cup I'd be issued. I didn't know, and the other women had not told me. They laughed as I dug a soda can out of the trash. I used it to drink water out of for the next 18 months. Jail is the perfect incubator for a police-like attitude, but there are cops in every environment. Backstage at the Mars Room, women would critique other women for not having fancy costumes or a choreographed and skillful floor show. Who cares? The job is about making money, not wasting it on costumes. And yet there were women in the dressing room who wanted there to be a set of rules to stripping. They believed you had to put on a good show and buy expensive costumes because it was more dignified and professional, respectful of some standard they wanted to uphold. But most of us worked in that environment because we were the kind of people who did not believe in standards and would never try to uphold any. You don't have to believe in anything to work at the Mars Room. The Russian women, when they started dancing at the Mars Room, brought a new post-Soviet ruthlessness, a bracing lack of regard for costuming and glamour, for anything that wasn't directly tied to profit. Most did hand jobs in the audience, which cut the rest of our business way back. The sleaziest types of men arrived at the club in thin and slippery track pants for maximum contact, but many were less experienced or more gentlemanly. Some didn't even want a girl on their lap, but next to them, for talking. I found the track pants type preferable. There was almost no work involved, no smiling, no fake personality, no pretend complicity. They moved you around how they wanted, and you didn't have to exert yourself, and for $20 per song. But after the Russian women invaded our club, the men all started requesting actual hand jobs for $20 a song. The Russian women undercut the rest of us. They siphoned the money out of all the wallets. We gathered in the common area of our new housing unit while we waited for bed assignments. It was a big cinder block building with rows of cells on two tiers. Everything was either raw concrete or painted a shade of dirty pink. Women in the cells pressed their faces to the narrow glass window of each door to stare at us. One woman shouted through the door that we looked like a bunch of ugly-ass scrubs. "Hey, scrub! Hey, stupid! Come wipe my ass! Lick my cunt while you're at it!" She kept yelling until a guard hammered on her door with his baton. Laura Lipp sat down next to me. I tried to move, but Jones barked at me. "You sit where I put you. This isn't musical chairs." "Next to the baby killer," Fernandez said, not quietly. "You two are like the Bobbsey twins," Fernandez said. Who are the Bobbsey twins? No one seems to know. She meant we were alike, because white, and I was going to have to do something, break away from Laura Lipp. "How many of you are dyslexic?" Jones asked our group of 60. Every person raised their hand except me. Jones did a head count and didn't notice my own had remained down. That was fine with me. As I came to understand, the Americans with Disabilities Act was often the only barrier left preventing them from treating us with unlimited abuse. Laura Lipp took this moment as a chance for further bonding. "I'm not really dyslexic, but they give you extra time for filling out forms this way. Do you like to read?" I looked away. I tried to catch someone else's eye, but no one would look at me. "If you eventually make it to the honor dorm, the girls there share books, although most read trash." Jones began by deciphering for us loudly the signs in the day room, since we were all dyslexic or presumed illiterate. The signs all began the same way. "Ladies, report to staff if you have a staph infection. Ladies, no whining. Ladies, out of bounds results in an automatic 115. The warning shot sign was more blunt. No warning shots in this area. The clock on the wall had a red wedge from 5 minutes to the hour until 5 minutes past the hour. That was for the women who could not tell time. Jones explained the red wedge. "All you need to know," she said, "is that when the big hand is on red, room doors are on unlock." Everything in prison is addressed to the woman for whom the red wedge is painted on the clock face, the imbecile. I've never met her. Plenty I have met in prison cannot read, and some cannot tell time. But that doesn't mean they are not shrewd and superior individuals who can outsmart any egghead. People in prison are clever as hell. The imbecile the rules and signs are meant to address is nowhere to be found. Jones read the guide to the handbook, and then the handbook itself. There were rules about everything, appearance and thoughts and letters and language, food and attitude and scheduling, tools and implements and use. Many instructions on who not to touch, anyone, or where, nowhere, and certainly no fornication was allowed, as Jones emphasized, saying the word slowly like a horny preacher.
"What is fornication again?" Conan asked.
"It's just fucking, right?" Women started dropping off to sleep. We'd been on an all-night ride, and everyone was exhausted. Jones never looked up, didn't cease her mechanical reciting. I nodded off too, but was woken by screams. The pregnant girl was clutching her stomach and crying out. Jones glanced at her and licked her thumb and turned a page of the handbook, continuing to read. She had to read the whole 80-page guide and the guide to the guide every week on Fridays when the new busload arrived, and so she knew it well, could speed-read it in order to take a longer break. The pregnant girl interrupted Jones's reading of the rules by going into labor. "I told you that women enjoy participating in the punishment of their fellow prisoners, but it's not always true. Some of us helped that day in receiving." Jones told everyone to stay seated and wait for medical. Fernandez ignored Jones's orders and went to help the girl, the same girl she'd been yelling at on the bus. So did I. It was my chance to break away from Laura Lipp, and I could not bear to watch this helpless kid suffer alone. She was screaming in agony. Fernandez and I each held a hand. Conan blocked Jones and the other receiving cops from getting near us. When they pepper-sprayed Conan, he only grew more irate. He shoved Jones to the ground. An alarm sounded. I kept on talking to the girl. I reminded her to breathe. She said no over and over, like she didn't want to have a baby, like she could prevent the future from merging into the now. Cops poured into our unit. Four of them tackled Conan. "You're going to be all right," I kept telling the girl. It wasn't true, since she was in prison, but I comforted her as best I could, until more cops streamed in and yanked me away from her and put me in restraints. They were not attending to the girl in labor. She was alone and crying out in pain. Fernandez, like Conan, was courageous. They sprayed her and she didn't seem to notice. She kept resisting them until they tasered her and put her in a cage. I was put in a cage, too. The cages were not quite big enough, and I had to keep my head low on my neck. I had become the turkey on the freeway. Conan was practically stuffed into the thing. Conan in a cage was even worse than Conan in a muumuu. He filled the cage all glare and rippling muscle. We were all three going to administrative segregation. My first day in prison, and I had already blown my parole board hearing, which was in 37 years. Medical had arrived, but it was too late to move the girl. She was fully in labor. She had the baby in receiving. It let out a cry that echoed through the concrete room, a piercing shriek of existence. A birth should be joyous. This was a lonely birth. The mother was in the hands of the state, and so was the baby, and they each only had that one tie to bureaucracy. The correctional officers seemed to think it was funny to see a baby in receiving. There aren't supposed to be any babies. The baby was contraband. Jones was shaking her head, as if a birth here in her unit was one more example, further proof of our inability to live in society. The medics put the girl on a stretcher. She asked to hold her baby, but her request was ignored by the medics, one of whom held the little newborn away from his body like it was a sack of garbage that might leak. Jackson was born at SF General, where they have to take you even without insurance. The nurse put him on my chest and he looked up at me, a wet, wild creature who had crawled from a swamp, all eyes, eyes wide, and his cry was not hysterical. Not a lament, but an earnest question. Are you here? Are you here for me? I was crying too, and I kept answering, I'm here, I'm right here. A nurse cleaned him up and put him in a clear plastic box, and all night, different nurses and orderlies came in and out, prodding and poking and bothering him. I was there, as I'd promised, but I was not his protector. Jackson's dad was a doorman at the Crazy Horse, a club down the street from the Mars Room, where I also worked on occasion. He went out with his friends the night his own son was born,
instead of hanging out with me in the miserable recovery room, which I shared with another woman who also had no companion and watched television all night. Every time Jackson's dad came around to my apartment in the days and weeks after Jackson was born, I yelled at him for being a deadbeat, which he was, so he stopped visiting. I didn't want him around, but when I heard he died of an overdose, I could not look at poor little Jackson without feeling rotten. He'd lost his loser dad. He had only one person to rely on. He bobbled his head on his neck, his big wet blue eyes gazing at me in myopic wonder, his hair a crown of fuzz standing at attention, and he did not know he was fatherless. He knew only that I was the one. I was the one. I was living out in the avenues then. When Jackson was 3 months old, the owner sold my apartment building. New management cleared the tenants to raise the rent. The city was changing. Rents were high. It was either live with my mother, who never offered that, probably because we fought and she was tired of me, or move to the Tenderloin where you could still get an affordable studio if you could tolerate the atmosphere in those buildings. I moved to Taylor Street, Eva Land, as I thought of it. I went back to the Mars room and paid my new neighbor to watch Jackson. My neighbor had a 3-year-old and was in a similar situation. No money, raising her daughter alone. She watched Jackson a lot, especially after I started dating Jimmy Darling. We three hovered in our turkey cages while Jones bullied the other prisoners into sitting down for the rest of their orientation. Everyone was agitated. People were crying. Jones told them to shut up and reminded them that they had made choices, that Sanchez, as she called the girl who'd had the baby, had made really poor choices and should have thought about her baby's future before she broke the law. Jones summoned porters, two gloomy white girls with cornrowed hair and a braided skin, to clean up from the birth. It was impossible to know if they were sad about the situation at hand or in a general and permanent sort of way. The gloomy porters squirted state cleaners and blasted hoses. Soapy runoff filled the drains. The baby's shriek stayed in my head as I sat in my cage, long after it and its mother were gone. They were in no hurry to deal with us. Incapacitated, in cages, we could be left to wait, to stare at the dirty pink walls while someone slowly, slowly filled out paperwork for our transfer from receiving to administrative segregation, which was even worse than regular prison. Unfortunately for that baby, it was a girl. Chapter 8. Please provide employment history over last 5 years. Please be thorough and detailed. On the job experience section of the form, the suspect wrote that she had experience as an employee. The intake officer explained that this would not be sufficient. On the transcript of the suspect's interview with homicide detectives, when asked what kind of work he normally did, the suspect answered, "Recycling." "Quality control," she wrote, for type of work. "I'm an employee," he'd told them, but seemed unable to specify what kind. Recycler, maintenance crew. Retail, wholesale, flyer distribution, warehouse distribution, dollar store, Dollar Tree, distribution warehouse, Walmart. He said he handed out flyers. He had written recycler. They both worked with a crew that handed out flyers. He delivered free newspapers, but not regularly. He worked at a distribution warehouse. She wrote, "Quality control." He said he worked part-time helping a friend who cleaned dollar stores after hours. Cashier. Unemployed. Not currently employed. QC, which she explained, meant quality control. Truck unloader. Package handler. He unpacked crates, he told them, at a distribution warehouse. When asked what she did for a living, the suspect said she worked. Recycling, he'd written. He brought recycling to a redemption center, he explained. recycler, 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 recycler. Redemptions, he told them. Redeemer was what she wrote. The suspect said she had mostly made her living by collecting bottles and cans. Chapter 9. When you Google the town of Stanville, faces pop up. Mugshots. After the mugshots, an article that cites Stanville as having the highest percentage of minimum wage workers in the state. Stanville's water is poisoned. The air there is bad. Most of the old businesses are boarded. There are dollar stores, gas stations that serve as liquor outlets, and coin-op laundry. People without cars walk the main boulevard in the hottest part of the day, when it's 113 degrees outside. They amble along in the gutter of the road, scooting empty shopping carts, piercing the dead zone of late afternoon with the cart's loose metallic rattle. There are no sidewalks. Stanville is synonymous with its prison, like Corcoran is, and Chino, Delano and Chowchilla and Avenal, Susanville and San Quentin, scores of towns that house prisons and share a name up and down the state. Gordon Hauser found a place to rent, sight unseen, a cabin up the mountain from Stanville proper, in the western Sierra foothills. The cabin was one room with a wood stove. It would be his Thoreau year, he wrote to his friend Alex, sending him the realty link. Your Kaczynski year, Alex wrote back, after looking at the photos of the cabin. True, both lived in one-room huts, Gordon responded, but I don't see much connection between them. Reverence of nature, self-reliance. Kay was even a reader of Walden, Alex wrote. It's on the list of books from his cabin. Also, R.W.B. Lewis, your idol. Aren't you kind of oversimplifying? Yes, but also, both died virgins. Kaczynski's not dead, Alex, Gordon wrote back. You know what I mean. But Thoreau was worried about trains, Gordon replied. Ted Kaye lived in the time of the atomic bomb. He lived through the technological destruction of the world. I confess that it is, of course, a significant difference. Can't remove either from historical context. Plus, Thoreau would have made a deeply inadequate mail bomb. His inflammatory act of resistance was not getting a welcome mat for his place. For goodbye beers at their bar on Shattuck Avenue, Alex gave Gordon, as a kind of joke, a Ted Kaczynski reader. Gordon had looked at the manifesto. Everyone had. The guy had briefly been a young professor at Berkeley. They toasted Gordon's departure. To my rustication, Gordon said. Isn't that when they boot you from Oxford? They just send you down to the country for a while. Gordon left downtown Oakland in the late afternoon and drove east and south. Tunneling through the dark and flat expanse of big agriculture along Highway 99, a burnt smell of synthetic fertilizer coming into the air vents, even on recirculate, he began to see an orange glow way off the freeway, a huge nimbus surrounded by darkness. A mysterious light source, as if there were a large factory out in the middle of the night-black fields. It was them, he knew. The women. 3,000 of them. Just like at NCWF, it was a place where there could be no night because security was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He checked in at a Holiday Inn. He would meet the property manager in the morning, get the keys to his new place. He wanted to ask the girl behind the hotel desk if she knew anyone who worked at Stanville Prison. He did not ask. He asked if the tap water in town was okay to drink. I'm not the type of person who drinks tap water, the girl said, upward lilting. He asked if she could recommend a place to eat. Now, are you a fried shrimp lover? Apparently, that was also a type. Gordon's mountain place had a poisoned water supply, not from agriculture. There was naturally occurring uranium, so you had to bring in bottled water. He liked the cabin. It smelled of fresh-planed pine. It was logical in its compactness, cozy even. It was up on stilts on a steep hill with few neighbors and had an enormous view of the valley. He was meant to report to his new job in a week. He spent his days unpacking his meager belongings and chopping wood, went for walks. Nights, he fed logs to his stove and read. Ted Kaczynski, Gordon learned, ate mostly rabbits. Squirrels, Ted reported, didn't seem to like bad weather. The Ted diaries were mostly concerned with how he lived and what he saw happening in the wilderness around him, and Gordon could see that comparing him to Thoreau was not as crude as he'd first suspected. But Ted would never write this. Through our own recovered innocence, we discern the innocence of our neighbors. Gordon's new neighbors were all white, Christian, and conservative. People who tinkered with trucks and dirt bikes and made assumptions of Gordon that he did nothing to dispel, because he knew those assumptions would work in his favor if he needed their help. It snowed up there. Roads closed, cutting off access to supplies. Trees fell and knocked down power lines. In summer and autumn, fires raged through. Gordon did not enjoy the grinding zing of dirt bikes' two-stroke motors, which echoed down the valley on weekends. But that was the country, not a pure and untrammeled world of native wildlife and songbird calls, but country people, who cleared the trees off their property with chainsaws and paved or laid astroturf, cleared paths through the woods for motocross courses and snowmobiling. Gordon withheld judgments. These people knew much more than he did about how to live in the mountains, how to survive winter and forest fires and mudflows from spring rains, how to properly stack wood, as Gordon's neighbor from down the hill had patiently showed him after his two cords of chunk wood were dumped in the driveway by a guy named Beaver who was missing most of his fingers. Gordon learned to split logs, part one of his rustication. The guy down the road who helped Gordon stack his wood had a wife or a girlfriend. Gordon had not met her, but he'd heard the two of them arguing. Voices echoed up the hills. One night in those early days of his new life in the mountains, Gordon was woken by what he thought was a woman's scream from out in the deep dark. He fumbled for the lamp. He was sure it was the neighbor's wife. Their place was down the hill, maybe 300 yards. He heard another scream. A frightened shriek. This time, closer. It sounded like someone in trouble. He went out on the deck in his underwear. There were no lights on at his neighbor's place. He stood for a long time, but heard nothing more. He decided he could not take the chance. He put on clothes and walked down his hill in the direction from which the sound had come. He stood on the road and tried to listen. There was no moon, and his eyes did not adjust. He could see almost nothing, just the vaguest outline where the tops of the tallest pines met the sky. The way the stars flickered unevenly, from bright to dimmer to brighter, reminded him of car headlights. A car at night, moving along a tree-lined road, lights shining intermittently. But stars were wondrous, and headlights could be sinister. Stars were nature. Cars were unknown human intent. Air sent the trees hissing and rushing, and he wondered if wind was what made stars flicker, a wind out there that was continuous with this wind here. He heard it again, the woman's shriek, farther away now. He called out, "Is anyone there? Are you okay?" He stood in the cold and waited. He heard only wind. He walked up the hill and got back into bed, tried to sleep and could not. Chapter 10. Out walking in the bitter cold, I spotted a porcupine in a tree and shot it. At first it seemed to be dead, but then I noticed that it was still breathing. Because of the thick hair and quills, I couldn't see where the brain area of its head was. I put my gun against what I guessed should be about right and fired. It was difficult to butcher because the skin didn't pull away from the flesh cleanly, and I had to watch out for quills. It had many tapeworms inside its abdomen, so after cleaning it, I washed my hands and my knife thoroughly in a strong solution of Lysol.
Naturally, I will cook the meat very well. This morning I went waiting in the snow for a couple of hours. When I got back, I boiled the rest of my porcupine. Heart, liver, kidneys, a few lumps of fat, and a large clot of blood taken from the chest. I ate the kidneys and part of the liver, which were delicious. I also ate part of the blood clot, which tasted good enough but had a dry texture that I didn't care for. After first thaw, dynamite blasts began booming all over the hills, occasionally audible at my cabin. Exxon conducting seismic exploration for oil. Couple of helicopters flying over the hills, lowering a thing with dynamite on cables, make blast on ground. Instruments measure vibrations. In late spring, I went and camped out, hoping to shoot up a helicopter in the area east of Crater Mountain. This proved harder than I thought because a helicopter is always in motion. Only once had half a chance. Two quick shots as copter crossed a space between trees. Both missed. When I got back to camp, I cried, partly from frustration at failing, but mostly from grief about what is happening to this countryside. It is so beautiful, but if they find oil, disaster.
Chapter 11. Okay, flush. Sammy Fernandez was teaching me how to pass things through the toilet. You run a line on the riser to send things up or down. Burritos, Twinkies, cigarettes, Pruno in a shampoo bottle. Sammy and I were sharing a cell in administrative segregation for the next 90 days, the punishment we both got for refusing officers' commands. We were in a 6-by-11-foot room with a toilet and two concrete beds with plastic mattresses. We talked to each other and took turns standing at the little window in our door to watch the hallway, otherwise known as Main Street, where, if you were lucky, you could see some other person on ADSEG being hustled to the showers in handcuffs with two cops behind her, which is ADSEG protocol. We were confined 24 hours a day, except for the two times a week that we each got taken down the hall for a shower, and once a week when we were given an hour of yard time in an outdoor cage. Death Row was underneath us in the same building. The cops call them Grade A. They say it about 50 times a day, and probably the prison administration thought it was bad for staff morale to say Death Row over and over. On our plumbing riser, one floor down, was an old friend of Sammy's, Betty LaFrance. Betty LaFrance, like the other women on Death Row, had access to canteen and contraband. We had access to Betty through the toilet and the air vent, and thank goodness, because Betty did not speak to just anyone, much less transmit burritos or bunk distilled liquor. She and Sammy had been in county jail together years earlier when Betty was fighting her case. "Is that my Chicana child, Sammy?" she'd shouted to us through the air vent on the first night. Betty had her black babies and her Chicana children, and Sammy was her favorite. Betty had been a leg model for Hanes Her Way pantyhose. Her legs are insured for millions. Her foot has that curve under it like a Barbie doll, but it's real. Sammy said Betty had stiletto heels in her cell on Death Row. She paid a cop hundreds to smuggle them in, just so she could put them on now and again and admire her own legs. Hundreds, millions. You can't believe anything people say, but what they say is all you have. Leg model or not, Betty's Pruno, like all Pruno, looked and smelled like vomit. The garbagey smell of Pruno is so distinct that when people are brewing, they disperse baby powder in the air of their cell to mask the scent. "That's the best hooch at Stanville, but you gotta double decant it, honey," Betty shouted to us up the air vent. "Don't forget to decant. It's got to breathe." She made it the usual way, with juice boxes poured into a plastic bag and mixed with ketchup packets as sugar. A sock stuffed with bread, the yeast, was placed in the bag for several days of fermentation. Betty sent up a wine glass next, the plastic kind with a screw-on base. "Where the hell did she get this glass?" "The regular way," Sammy said. "The vault or canoe." Women smuggled heroin, tobacco, and cell phones from visiting inside their vaginas and rectums. Betty was smuggling plastic stemware. Sammy and I passed the Pruno back and forth, and she told me Betty had arranged her husband's murder to get his life insurance. You don't talk about people's crimes, but Betty was different. Death Row was different. They were the big celebrities of Stanville, and celebrity gossip has a role. The hitman who killed her husband was her lover, but while she was waiting for the money to come through, Betty worried he was turning on her, so she had her hitman killed by a dirty cop she met at a bar in Simi Valley. She was going to have the second hitman, the dirty cop who'd killed the first hitman, knocked off when they caught her. She was afraid he'd squeal or threaten to and blackmail her. They were in Las Vegas, partying on her life insurance money. She asked a security guard at the El Cortez Casino if he would murder the cop for a payoff. "Honey, it was not the El Cortez," Betty yelled up the vent. "It was Caesar's Palace, and honestly, if you're going to tell my story and you don't know the difference between Caesar's and the El Cortez, there is just so much else you can't know. The El Cortez is for off-duty limousine drivers and Filipinos. Got nothing against them. Should have hired one to get rid of Doc while I had the chance." "Doc was the dirty cop," Sammy said. "He's tried to take a bounty on me about 5 times. You'd think a woman on death row could get some peace, be left alone." Among the evidence that led to Betty's conviction was a photo of her lying nude under a pile of money. The photo was taken by Doc, the dirty cop, just after she got her husband's life insurance payout. Betty loved money, Sammy said, and had slept with a pillow stuffed with bills in county jail. She asked Sammy to guard her pillow when she went to court. Sammy said she felt like a queen to think that a high-class person like Betty LaFrance trusted her with her pillow full of money. Betty and Doc had been arrested in Las Vegas. Sammy knew the stories, but any new audience for Betty was worth a repeat. She told us through the vent about the Nevada jail where she was held before they extradited her back to California. She said the girls there, the gals there, all worked. Every female in the Las Vegas County Jail had to count playing cards, put them in proper order to make decks for the casinos. They made her do it, she said, and her fingers got terribly chapped. We were buzzing by then from the hooch. "Did she ever show you that photo of her with the money? I wanted to see it." She had not, but Sammy said Betty had a whole file on herself down there, all the articles that had appeared in the newspapers, her trial transcript, everything. Her case was a big deal, big news, Sammy said. Betty hiring multiple hitmen, the cop implicated in a lot of other cases, major scandal with the LAPD. Sammy shouted down to Betty and asked if we could look at the photo. All I wanted in my drunken state, my full set of hopes and wishes, was to see this picture of the person whose voice I heard through the vent, a woman covered in money. But really I wanted to see anything besides the concrete walls of our tiny cell. Betty refused to send the photo through the toilet. She was afraid it would get damaged. You can wrap things tightly enough in plastic that no water seeps in. We send ice cream sandwiches from canteen through the toilets, wrapped in Kotex as insulation, then plastic wrap. She was playing hard to get. Sammy asked McKinley, the sergeant working ADSEG that night, if he'd pass a book from Betty for her to read. Everyone called him Big Daddy. "I gotta finish it, Big Daddy," Sammy said. "I read every chapter but the final one last time I was back here." If he said yes, Betty could slip the photo into the pages. "I can't do any passing, Fernandez. You get caught with property that ain't yours, they're gonna add time. You know that. I don't like to see my little girls suffer back here. Just follow the rules, Fernandez, and you'll be mainlined soon." "Big Daddy," Sammy said, "I wish you'd been my father. My whole life could have gone different." "Now, Fernandez," Sergeant McKinley said, "I'm sure your own father did the best job he could." We heard his boots moving down the hall. "I never knew my father," Sammy called after him through the food flap. "My mother didn't know him either. She's not even sure who he was." Betty heard us laughing, and that was what did it. She was no longer the center of attention and agreed to flush up the photo. After we got the 30 layers of plastic wrap unpeeled, Sammy unfolded a newspaper article that featured the incriminating image. I had pictured a classic nude with a bikini of $100 bills, the long tan legs insured for millions. The image was of a woman lying on a bed, stony as a corpse, with an enormous landslide of money crushing her, only her head emerging from the pile. She looked as if a gravel truck had backed up to the bed and slid its multi-ton load over her, entombing her in money. We didn't either of us say a word. Sammy folded up the image, rewrapped it, and sent it down the pipes. Our once-weekly yard time was not a real yard, just the Adseg yard, a small concrete area wrapped in razor wire. But we got to see Conan out there on his own adjacent razor wire concrete patch. Conan did push-ups and talked to me about cars. It had started when Conan asked where I was from. "Frisco, huh?" he said, "where they were doing that extended axle thing back in the 90s. Pokers. Man, you guys have something to answer to." To say Frisco is as goofy and wrong as an extended axle, but Conan was right. It was as if one morning I'd woken to discover that every neighbor on my block had extended their axles so that the wheels of the cars stuck out on both sides. Now it was a distant memory, something unfashionable. That was before I'd moved from the avenues downtown when the city was invaded, and I could no longer afford anything but a place in the Tenderloin. Extended axles were no less important than any other memory we made the subject of our talk, life as we had known it. Conan and I reminisced about big rims, floater rims, spinners, neon undercar kits, Holley-carbs and Hemis, popular trucks and SUVs, the Chevrolet Intruder, the Dodge Rendition. The Intruder, Conan and I agreed, looked like something that was designed to be inserted in something else. "There's a new Nissan coming out called the Cube," Conan said. "You can only get it in Japan. But who wants a square car? The Cube. Now there's an aerodynamic concept. Nissan makes these trucks you can hacksaw the catalytic converter off in 3 minutes. I can't walk past one without stealing the muffler. I should sue the manufacturer for forcing criminal behavior on me." We laughed about the smart car. Those looked to me like the cap on a furniture leg, a blunt vertical thing that scooted around. "What did you drive?" Conan asked me. "63 Impala," I said. "Dang." "Hell yeah," Sammy said. "That's my girl." But the moment I said it, the fun cracked to pieces. I had no car anymore. "You know what I hate is when people put open headers on an Escalade," Conan said, as I tried to steer my thoughts back, to listen, to not care about anything. "Fuck Escalades. Something about them is plastic. Cheap. I'd take an Eldorado, though. The 70s is the end of good American cars. We used to make trucks in this country. Now we make truck nuts. Those ugly things dangling over the road at 80 miles an hour? I didn't know they were called that." The idea that men would want to display an artificial scrotum, the most fragile part of a man's body, on the back of their trucks, I said it made no sense, and Conan agreed. "Where's the pride in towing those from a bumper? If I was a dude, I'd tow a big-ass trailer with a Harley on it," Conan said. "Or I'd just ride a Harley." "I heard you bragging to McKinley that you do ride a Harley," I said. "That's what I mean. If I was a dude, I'd be like I am right now, except not locked up." Sammy told us she'd owned a Trans Am at age 15. Her dealer and boyfriend, Smokey, had given it to her. "I know a Smokey," Conan said. I did, too, not personally. The Smokey I knew of was Smokey Unick, the NASCAR builder. Smokey Unick was someone Jimmy Darling and I had bonded over. Smokey Unick cheated in all of his NASCAR innovations, but everyone else did, too. Also, when he was a young stock car racer, He raced with one arm out the window, resting on the sill. Smokey Unick had swagger, but Smokey Unick was dead. I was in prison. Jimmy was wherever, with some other woman, no doubt, and whoever the other woman was reminded me of what I was not.